Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're building bridges, not walls, to keep out the world's peoples or apartheid structures to segregate and divide. We speak with Sarah Jaffe, labor journalist and author of Work Won't Love You Back. I got to tell that to my employer, about what she describes as one of the most important labor stories in the country. Sarah Jaffe, you've given us an extremely enthusiastic and wonderful story. The full name of our show is not just Building Bridges. It's Building Bridges, Your Community Labor Report. And for decades, we've been waiting for the working class to come together, unions to think of people in their full reality, their identity, where they live, how they work, how they organize, and for the community to understand that ultimately empowerment is based on the coalition with the sources of production and the working class coming together. So you've got this great story. Do start us off with, isn't it being a little arrogant to say that one of the most important labor stories in the country is Minneapolis?
No, why would it be? I mean, I think it's a little arrogant to assume all the best labor stories are on the East Coast.
I said Minneapolis. I meant Minnesota, but...
yes, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the surrounding suburbs.
And, right. Ken said the Minneapolis general strike for sure. Yeah, we are a bit chauvinistic and arrogant from New York. The revolution has not started here. But do get us started on this very, very strategic, important development that you do a wonderful story on.
Yeah, I think what's happening in Minneapolis, or in the Twin Cities, let's say, is so interesting precisely because it has been developing for 10, 12 years on the ground. I first started covering what was going on in Minnesota during and after the Occupy movement, when the spinoff of Occupy Homes, which did have at least, you know, some start in New York, really took off in Minneapolis and in Atlanta. And so Occupy Homes there was an attempt to move out of parks and into trying to keep people in homes that they were being evicted from or foreclosed upon. And that's one of many connections that have been made in that, in those cities, in that area since then. So we're seeing things like unions working with worker centers, which is not, again, rare to anybody who's watching labor in New York City. But those relationships can often be really fraught. And in the Twin Cities, they've managed to have pretty extensive, deep, and collaborative relationships where the unions that often have more money and more power are not sort of walking all over their smaller community partners, you know? And then when combined with that, you see housing organizing, like I mentioned, and climate organizing and organizing around police violence and police killings, all of this coming together to, you know, to say that workers, as people have said many times before me, don't live single issue lives. And so thinking about the four main demands that this this network of organizations made this past week were around fair wages, but also about decent housing, good schools, and a livable climate. And when you think about that, right, it's we're literally breathing the same air. We're all living in cities that, you know, to whatever degree, maybe not as expensive as New York, but we're all living through housing crises wherever we are. We're watching decades of underfunding of schools and other public services chip away at our quality of life. And all of that, you know, starts in the workplace with crappy wages, abusive bosses, all of that fun stuff. So when you look at it that way, right, these are interests that we all have. And so workers and members of all these community groups who are also workers, right? Because again, the community member is a worker somewhere else most of the time, unless you're lucky enough to be retired or independently wealthy or a child. And so they come together around one demand or one question, which was, what could we win together? And that involved lining up things like contract expiration dates for the different unions, actions that different worker centers could have, deadlines that other kinds of action could have that weren't necessarily a contract expiration, but that could be a target for action, so that all week you had workers on strike, you had picket lines, you had informational pickets, you had marches on the boss, you had community meetings, you had debates around the future of social housing in Minnesota. You sort of saw everything in the streets in 1 week, which is kind of amazing.
Now, this, I mean, what really struck me also was the diversity of the mm-hmm. different groups, both within the community and the labor. Not only that, but you've got groups that are black and white and brown. Mm-hmm. And give us some kind of fill in some of those gaps as to who we were talking about, that it's not just like mm-hmm. teachers or lawyers, or give us some idea about the kinds of people we're talking about.
Yeah, so you had the two teachers unions in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and also the school services workers, right? So everybody in the schools who's not a teacher, they're organized in a different union with SEIU. There's SEIU Local 26, which is a lot of building services workers, a lot of whom are Black and Latino. You have worker centers like SITUL, which is primarily in the Latino community, but they're organizing everybody from restaurant workers to janitors to construction workers. You have a group called Unidos Minnesota, which is working around green jobs in the climate future, and also things like retrofitting homes, which you can imagine in Minnesota, trying to have climate safe homes is kind of important because it gets really cold in the winter and really warm in the summer. You have organizations like IX, which is a tenants union, again, that started out primarily in Latino community and has branched out from there. And they've actually recently won actual buildings, control of buildings away from a landlord and into a community-owned cooperative. So you really have like quite a variety of different organizations that are some based in ethnic communities, some based in particular workplaces, some based in issues, right, when we're talking about climate change. But all of them, again, are facing the same issues that, again, I would say most working class people are facing, which is like the rent's too damn high, the wages are too damn low, everything is on fire, and the kids need to go to school.
Yeah. What I want to know is what many of us have been trying to create these coalitions mm-hmm. for a long time. So here you have before March 2nd, right? 15,000 workers had already taken strike votes. Right. And though some of them had settled, some 10,000 more may still walk off the job this coming week and stuff. But how? Yeah. What was the spark that created this wonderful wonderful prairie fighter? How do, to go back into Ken's question, really, the diversity, unfortunately, mm-hmm. we don't come from the kind of society where people perceive of themselves as a working class, that race and, of course, the issues of misogyny and sexual identification mm-hmm. and orientation and so on have kept us mm-hmm. very siloed. What in the world was the spark that created this marvelous prairie fire and brought people together? What could
I think it's several things, right? You sort of have things like the Occupy movement that got people thinking we are the 99% and not we are building service workers or we are teachers or we are, renters with a crappy landlord. But actually, think about we are the 99%. What does that really mean? You have some of the unions that had progressive leadership either take over fairly recently or have been there for a while. The building services local, for instance, is in the tradition of Justice for Janitors, which is a movement from the late 80s, early 90s around organizing janitorial workers, again, who are mostly outsourced contract workers, mostly Latino. And that was a different way of thinking about doing that kind of organizing that they really never let go of in that area. And then you had successive movements for Black Lives waves, right? So you had the killing of Jamar Clark in 2015, which sparked an occupation of the police precinct. Then you had the killing of Philando Castile, who was a schools worker. And that really had a huge impact on the schools unions, right? Because it wasn't just saying Black Lives Matter at school. It was like literally one of our coworkers was just killed by the police. The St. Paul Federation of Teachers and then the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers are following the examples of bargaining for the common good that comes out of places like Chicago, right? St. Paul was one of the early teachers unions that followed Chicago down that path of social justice unionism. And then one of the leaders of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers was one of the people who was in George Floyd Square in 2020, right? When George Floyd was killed. George Floyd was killed half a block away from the building that Situl and IX have their offices in, which is just a sort of horrific coincidence. But it meant that these organizations had space on that block to be ground zero. So people could do everything from get food and water and masks to, you know, because it was still peak pandemic, to get away from tear gas. And in those moments, you build a lot of trust that you kind of can't force otherwise. You know, I think the Minneapolis being the center of that uprising, we can kind of forget. And also, you know, when it kicked off in 2020, it's always surprising because you never know exactly when it's going to happen. But it didn't surprise me at all that it was happening in Minneapolis, because I'd been following the organizing that had been going on the ground in these places, and the work of groups like the Black Visions Collective, and now the New Justice Project, to consolidate on the, saying the shift in analysis feels like too academic to say, right, that happens in these streets. But when you think about before 2020, we were talking, largely the big political conversation was like police reform. And then really after 2020, people were saying defund the police, abolish the police. Those leaps don't just happen, right? They happen because people have been organizing around those demands beforehand, and then they are able to spread from there. And they were able to spread from somewhere like Minneapolis because people on the ground had been making those demands and doing that actual work of moving money away from policing and into different community services, schools, parks, things like that, that all of the workers involved in this week of action work on, right? You've got park service workers, say, right, who can suddenly see that, like, oh my God, all this money is going into the police that we could be paying more to do. When I spoke with the head of he's the business manager of the La Yuna local, right, which is a laborers union that works. They represent the park service workers, sewer maintenance workers, basically all of the messy, dirty stuff that we rely on that we forget about until it breaks, they do. And he was telling me that one of the things that has happened in recent years is that they get called in when the city evicts a homeless encampment. So suddenly these workers who are supposed to be, you know, keeping the parks clean are now being tasked with helping the city evict people who are unhoused. And they're saying, we don't want to be doing that. We're not trained for that. We, you know, this could be alleviated if the city actually made sure people had homes. And so you have these moments of sort of organic shifts that also have an impact where they are, right? That it advances the way people are thinking about their interests, not just as members of a specific union, but as a class and as a community, as the people of the Twin Cities who all have to live and work and interact together.
So, you know, there was, you're calling it, and I love the phrase, it's so correct, an ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
An ecosystem, and you mentioned something very specific, and I still want to dig deeper into the how.
Yeah.
Local 26 and Centro de Trabajadores Unidos en la Lucha, right? A
yes.
worker center
yes.
And a local. Now, yeah. quite frankly, there has been no love of labor's lost between the generally the construction trades and mm-hmm. worker centers. And we mm-hmm. come for such a rapidly
yeah.
anti-immigrant context, particularly
yeah.
with mm-hmm. the opportunism of the electoral system, both parties really.
Yes.
So the unions have never, aside from the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and unions that were made up almost exclusively of immigrant workers, they've never been great on working with worker centers. There's always mm-hmm. a kind of contempt. How in the world did this partnership, this ecosystem, this ecosystem really develop?
Yeah.
It's so exciting and it's so encouraging, and we need to replicate it here because we yeah. need to become less fragmented and really become a
yeah.
movement for the empowerment of the working class.
Yeah. I mean, so two things here, because I want to sort of separate what you just said there into two parts. The first thing is the ecosystem thinking. I got that from my friend and comrade, Rodrigo Nunez, who wrote a wonderful book called Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal. And the way he talks about it, I think, is so compelling because it's a way of thinking about your organizing where, you know, you might be organizing as, say, a tenants union, and therefore your interest is in getting the rent lowered, getting this landlord out of your tenant, your members' lives, whatever it is. But you can think, how does what I'm demanding here coincide with what other people are demanding, what other organizations are demanding? How does it help them if we advance our demands, right? So if they are now, one of the things they're organizing around is social housing, and they want locally funded and controlled social housing rather than, you know, public housing that's funded by HUD and all of that, which, you know, again, I don't have to tell New Yorkers anything about the problem with the federally funded public housing. But the doing that, what if they also demand that those buildings, if they're built, they have to be built by contractors making union rates, that have to sign on to CITUL's demands that they've made around safe and fair contracting? What if they are built to green specifications? And that means, you know, everything from making them more attractive to the surrounding community to actually, you know, helping to mitigate the damn climate crisis or even just the clear in the neighborhood, right? That you can think about that in a way that literally affects the ecosystem where you are, but also affects all the other organizations that you might be working with, right? So thinking about organizing ecologically, right? It doesn't mean that you sort of give up all your autonomy and follow Local 26 wherever they say we're going. But it is to say that, like, we think about how are we, A, not screwing over our partners, our comrades, our neighbors, and B, how does our work complement each other so that we can make these demands in sort of overlapping and synchronous ways while also, you know, going out on a limb and testing something and saying, maybe this will work and maybe it won't. And knowing that, like, others will have your back if there's a, you know, momentary screw up, right? If something goes wrong. And so thinking about CITUL and the building trades is a really interesting example, right? Because it comes from their work alongside Local 26, organizing janitors in big box stores. And that is, again, that's organizing the janitors who work at places like Target, which is headquartered in the Twin Cities. So that was an important way to Target.
Yes.
By saying
every
this company, its headquarters is right here, right? We can put pressure on this company and say, you are hiring janitors for minimum wage and stealing their wages. And yeah, maybe it's a subcontractor, but Target's ultimately responsible. And they succeeded in that, right? So the janitors at these retail stores have union contracts now, right? One of a couple of the people that I spoke to in the story have union contracts because of that organizing. So the building trades look at that and say, oh, wait, this works. And also, you know, whether or not people like it, immigrant workers are here in the US. They're working right now. They're doing things. And a lot of the time in the building trades, they're doing work that the big unions maybe don't think about or don't want or sort of dismiss as being beneath them. But that still creates a space to lower wage scales, to lower safety protections, right? If you have a bunch of workers who are working under the table, who are not being supervised by people who give one tiny iota about their safety, this has an effect on standards everywhere, even if the unions at first kind of think like, oh, we don't care about those guys anyway, they're the competition. So, you know, thinking practically about these workers are here, they're doing the work. How do we make it better and safer and lift the floor for everyone so that our conditions don't go down to where theirs are? And also just looking at the work Situl had done with this other union and saying like, oh, these guys are good at what they do, you know, and thinking like, okay. And I, you know, I must say like the unions are not perfect on this by any stretch of the imagination, but the labor movement in this country has been realizing that immigrant workers are here. They are part of the workforce. They are part of our communities. They are our neighbors. They are our friends. And also that, like, frankly, they often bring a lot of organizing knowledge from their countries of origin, from other places that they've lived and worked, from political traditions that have been crunched in this country. And we can learn a lot from the tactics and strategies that they have, right? So some of these organizations in Minnesota are taking inspiration from things like the Zapatistas, right? And thinking about autonomy and how do we manage to do real democracy means that we get to make decisions for ourselves, that we have self-determination within our community, within our neighborhoods, within our housing, within our schools. That kind of political tradition that, like, you know, tried to mash out of us in this country. Some of these workers are coming in with that knowledge that they can bring a level of not only militancy, but like real experience to organizing.
The 30s, you know? Revisited. My gosh, where did the labor movement come from in so many ways? All these radical traditions from abroad, the immigrant workforce, and of course, the Zapatistas of Mexico. Right. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Well, time is flying, and you have many, many subjects that you're talking about that are not always in this country. So why don't we shift gears just a bit and talk about the tech workers organizing against the humiliation and the attacks in Gaza.
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of questions to start there, but one of the things that I think is really interesting about the tech worker organizing, right, is that they're organizing around the products that they make. And if you look at the sort of division of labor in a lot of these big tech companies, workers regularly have no idea what they're making. They're being asked to work on some portion of code for some portion of thing. And they really don't know what it's going to be used for. And then they find out by reading in the news that this company has signed this, you know, massive deal to build some AI program for the Israeli military or something like that, or the American military or the police or whatever it is. And so we've seen this organizing that really got, it started before Trump was elected, but it really got jump-started in 2016, where a lot of tech workers were saying, we don't want to make a Muslim registry. We don't want to help you, you know, militarize the border. We don't want to do any of these things. And we want to pressure these companies that have a public face, right, a consumer-facing outlet, sort of like the pressure on Target that I was just talking about, to not be evil, which used to be Google's tagline. And so we're seeing that again now where, again, these big tech companies are making all of this tech that has been used in Gaza, has been used in the occupied territories, has been used in a variety of ways. And the workers are saying, like, actually, we didn't sign on to do this. We want not only to know what we're doing, but we want to say no to what we're doing here. We want to say that we want no part of this and that the company should have no part of this. And, you know, we saw a worker stand up and protest at a public event the other night and I believe got fired. And, like, we're... You know, again, we're seeing this over and over and over again with these companies. In the piece I wrote for The Progressive, I quote Alex Hanna, who is somebody I've known for a very long time because they were once upon a time involved in the Wisconsin Capitol uprising as the head of the grad students union back in Wisconsin in 2011. So Alex and I go way back. And Alex was working at Google's ethical AI department and is one of many people pushed out because Google no longer really cared about being ethical about its AI. But it turns out that, you know, you can't tell a bunch of tech workers that their opinions matter and that they're very important to the success of the company. And also, screw you, you don't get to have opinions, sit down and shut up.
Well, I must say that we need to have you back. We need you to actually come back with some of these marvelous networks of unions and community groups from Minnesota to continue to whet our appetite, to excite us who have worked together for more than a decade, to leverage their collective power and to educate, agitate, and organize the rest of us to do what? To empower the working class, to empower the total working class, where we live, where we work, and of course, for how we organize. Sarah Jaffe, you are marvelous, and I strongly recommend reading her book, which has this wonderful cynical title, Work. What? Work won't love you back when workers when workers decide what to make. But you know what? We love you. We love your enthusiasm, your energy, and bringing us these optimistic stories and helping us to realize that the power is within us. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and I'm telling you to continue to do what? Educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for another world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so. Thank you for listening.